Or he's to Oregon or California. And I really firmly believe in this bill with just about every part of me. I believe that if we're going to spend the money, we've already spent the money, then let's utilize what we paid for. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes. Questions? Representative Lyson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was an old history government teacher. I know Representative Cato was English. So on line 14, I really have a question for you here. Line 14 reads that there is no facility in the state able and available to perform the maintenance. Now, to me, when you use both able and available, it means that, for an example, if we had a facility in Ketchikan that was able to but was not available, they could still not, say, use another facility. Because when you use in, you mean both conditions must apply. Should that in not more properly be or? And wasn't that the intent? So that it would read that there is no facility in the state able or available. So in other words, if there was no facility that was able to,
you're very definitely correct,
do something else, or if it was not available, they could do something else.
Representative Larson, you're very definitely correct.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Bush, yes, questions.
I think I answered my own question here. The department had opposed the bill, and they'd recommended adding some language. You added that language to the transportation CS. Is that right? That at competitive prices in response to what they had suggested?
Yes, and I believe that there's an amendment coming up to take care of that also that will be proposed a little bit later. Representative Bush.
We do have Joe Camp here also with Department of Transportation, if you have any questions with the transportation. At this time, the chair will call up Ron Garzini and Mike Meehan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the benefit of the committee, I'm Ron Garzini, City Manager of Seward. Mr. Meehan is Vice Mayor of Seward, and we also have another council member, Mr. Hilton. Mr. Meehan and Mr. Hilton and I have been a team representing the city, traveling twice to the Orient, all over the Northwest, and the state of California and the state of Oregon, in the effort to secure private venture capital in the Seward Marine Industrial Center. So that yesterday, in traveling around, a couple of people said, well, I didn't even know Seward was building a shipyard. This, by the way, which I will pass around, is not an artist's rendition. This is the actual condition of the facility as of last fall. If I may pass this around.
What village was this again?
It's a suburb of Anchorage.
Go ahead, Ron.
I'm going to try and hit some of the high points that the others have spoken to, and then zero in on what we found in the efforts to locate venture capital, and why we feel that there are solutions that can make a very complex undertaking work. As Representatives Cato and Taylor have said, the state has spent over $74 million to develop the two marine repair facilities in Ketchikan and Seward. The city of Seward, interestingly enough, has spent $4.6 million of its own money to develop our facility. And we're real proud of that. And in fact, this year, we will do approximately $1.5 million worth of private sector work. We have a contract with FOSS to do their emergency maintenance. We're operating the facility on a short-term interim basis with two local operators, and a Kenai propeller operator, and a local radio repair operator in a real small fashion, obviously a lot less level than the legislature intended when they supported us building this yard. But we are managing to get some emergency repair. Almost everywhere we went, people talked about one of the bigger components of our potential operation, and that is repair of the vessels in the state of Alaska. We contracted with Chemical Bank of New York to help us market this facility, And they basically said the Seward facility can maintain 95% of the vessels in the Gulf of Alaska. They're in the order of 3,000 vessels in the Gulf of Alaska. That we will be a major asset to fisheries development in the Gulf of Alaska. We can serve offshore oil and gas. The problem is a chicken-egg problem. We need the venture and development capital, and clearly the state vessels, those vessels controlled by the state, are a major component of a potential market. One of the obvious logical operators to come in and venture the private dollars needed are the Seattle-based operators. They've been real frank with us. They've said, here I have a stable, trained, qualified, underemployed workforce in Seattle. I have all the equipment materials in place for the last 20 or 30 years, and all of our debt is retired. Why should I come up to Seward, Alaska, and spend several million dollars duplicating all these facilities when really all there is an unstable fishery and an unstable oil and gas business and a 5% bid preference on your ships in the marine highway system, which are about half. The governmental vessels are about half of the market that was determined by Chemical Bank. The examples they use for me are basically the salary differences are in the vicinity of 5%. The private capital down there has been invested and is in place and is debt-free. We have high unemployment and good competition right now in the Seattle marketplace. To show you how competitive Seattle is and how aware of ours and Ketchikan's efforts to develop major yards, very recently the City of Seward applied for an Economic Development Administration grant of $600,000 to develop our cradles and rails. To do that, the city had to pledge an additional $600,000 of our own money. We could not pledge state money, even if we received it. So we went ahead and did that, and we received a protest from a number of the Seattle-based yards. So the Seattle yards are not only aware of our efforts to try to come into the marketplace, but are using their leverage at the national level to stop us. We were able to defeat the Seattle yards' protest by using a number of pretty cute analogies. Number one is if Long Beach was trying to emerge into the marketplace, would Seattle say that they were sharing a common market? Another one is in the last 5 years, we've been able to locate a number of insurance casualties. That's fishery vessels that are damaged, that because of the danger and risk of hauling them across the Gulf of Alaska for repair in Seattle, the insurance companies have just taken them as a total write-off. So we clearly are an asset to the fisheries development, as well as we hope to the state vessel system. I called the deputy commissioner of Washington State and I said, how do you guys beat Oregon? I know Portland is trying to develop a shipyard. His comment is, we don't compete. The state of Washington ferry system does not compete its vessel repair in Oregon. Portland has a new and emerging yard. The Portland yard doesn't even get a chance to bid on Washington State ferry system, at least as in the last few months. Never has. The United States government, as we all know, doesn't bid its marine repair work in Japan or Korea, which are clearly the least expensive place to do the work. And they don't do it for a lot of excellent reasons, maintaining a strong American workforce, keeping our dollars in the U.S. of A., and so on. Our proposal is basically that we think that the DOT and the other state agencies should be directed by the legislature to see to it that Alaska's vessels are maintained in Alaska. Now, obviously, there needs to be some language as when practical, not when practical, except when it's not practical, or except when the skills are not here, but a firm commitment by the state of Alaska that these vessels will be maintained here will assist us in getting this private venture capital. What we would like to do is be able to go with our friends in Ketchikan and separate from them down to the Pacific Northwest and to the Orient and say, if you come into Alaska, you invest your capital dollars, then you can reasonably assume if your prices are good that we're going to give you an edge. And the edge may be different as you come into the marketplace. The benefits of it, capital formation, we think that this will cause an investment that is what we need to get this thing continued in the private sector. Local hire and training. I believe a skilled shipyard could bring in the equipment, could bring in a couple of supervisory personnel. In the case of Seward, work out a training agreement with the vocational center, and we could fill those jobs in short order. Competition. We've talked with our friends in Ketchikan, and There are a couple of the vessels in the Marine Highway Fleet that Seward would bid on. I would expect that Seward and Ketchikan would both bid, once in position, against one another for this business, for those vessels, that and similarly the other 13 vessels that are 65 feet or over. It'll keep us both yards sharper. Disadvantages, I tried to think of the disadvantages of this type of local hire legislation, and obviously one of them is what I call the Me Too. There may be other industries come to you and say, we want the same kind of help. It's our feeling that the legislature has targeted the marine repair business as an industry that you'd like to see the state of Alaska get into. You put $77 million of your money in it. We've put, as of now, $4.6 million of our money into it. And we can assure you we want to become competitive, because besides the state business, we want the private sector business too. There will be, maybe, we don't know, some impact on the operating budget. But I don't believe the difference will last, if there is any, very long. Lastly, I would like to ask Councilmember Meehan, who's the Vice Mayor, to just tell you about the efforts that the city has made to secure private investment.
Actually, I think Mr. Garzini has pretty well covered it, but I would like to reemphasize the effort. In the past 3 to 4 years, I've been very involved in it through the City of Seward and Councilmember Hilton and the mayors, Mr. Garzini, and we've met with it, probably 2 dozen companies around the world on the West Coast, and put a very aggressive effort together to try and encourage them to come in and invest in our community to employ our people, with very little success, unfortunately. We feel, and I sincerely feel, that with your help in this position, we could go back to the West Coast to the companies that are now doing the work for the Alaska boats, or on the Alaska boats, ferries, and others. And this would provide us with a tool, a new incentive for them to capitalize in the state of Alaska, in Seward and in Ketchikan, and come up here. And it may cost us initially, as Mr. Garzini pointed out, maybe through the DOT maintenance budget, a little bit more initially to provide this work in the state of Alaska. But by the time that this money would be being rolled over, the multiplier effect, I guess you refer to it, in our state. But we feel that what we'd like to see is more than one company, possibly two of the West Coast companies, coming up and competing with each other at our location in Seward, and possibly the same thing happening in Ketchikan. So we would have a competitive advantage there long term. And I think, as Mr. Garzini pointed out, eventually we'll get to a point once we've built the system through private dollars, the capitalization there, that it would be very competitive with the West Coast. And eventually I feel that it will save the state of Alaska money and provide jobs for our unemployed people. And as Representative Cato pointed out, I'm in the fisheries business, and I know there are a lot of people around that are able to do the work with a little bit more training, and some that will not need it in the state of Alaska. And we sincerely need your support and your help to give us this little bit of an edge that without a doubt we're going to require to encourage anyone to come in and provide the capital, private dollars, to build the system for us. Without it, there's just no incentive for them to come up here. They've got the work already. The 5% just won't cover the capital cost. So we sincerely need your support.
Yeah, I think that, just to add to that, I think that clearly the 5% will probably work or less at some time in the future. But our workmen at the beginning are not going to be as productive while they're in the training program and learning the processes. Additionally, it's possible that we may find that no incentive is needed, but we need something to kick these guys loose from laying back and saying, well, we can bid right now, and the edge isn't much. If they know that the work is going to be done here in Alaska, then I think there will be some competition to get in here and to get their foot in the door. I've seen Duwamish Shipyard guy every 3 months. I travel about the state talking to people in this business, and I see the Duwamish cups, the Duwamish caps. They're marketing our people all over, and I think if there's a commitment and Duwamish wants to keep this business, then Duwamish and Todd and a few of these others will take a real serious look about possibly investing in here. One other point I want to clarify. The reason I think that Seward and Ketchikan have a common interest is the majority of the vessels in the Marine fleet, we have no hope in Seward of dealing with. The major ferries are too large for the Seward facility, and virtually all of them are going to not want to come for good reasons across the Gulf of Alaska to our facility. But we are interested in the fish and game enforcement vessels that you'll see on that list. There's a lot of other vessels. The Alpha Helix, the university's research vessel that Representative Cato mentioned, is home-ported in Seward and recently had repairs without even checking with us. So that's basically our target, is the private ferries, the oil and gas vessels, the two small ferries in our waters, and the other state fish and game type vessels that are working in the Gulf. With that, thank you.
Ron, just getting away from this, would you take the picture, and Representative Cotton is in charge of corrections budget. Would you show the site selections of the prison, please, for members here?
Sure.
On that same picture, so they would know where it's going in.
Last fall, when this picture was taken, the DOT had cleared the property right back here for the Spring Creek Correctional Center. They're actually pouring concrete there now. It looks quite a bit different, but this is the prison site.
Is there any questions of... thank you, gentlemen.
Just one quick question. I don't know whether it's for these gentlemen or whether it's for the subcommittee. I sure agree with the concept. However, we have heard this afternoon of $77 million. Is that money that has already been spent on either the Ketchikan or the Seward facility? We also see that within the proposed amendment, it simply says a facility that is able and a facility that is available. It doesn't say anything about competitive price. So that would mean if the estimated cost of repairs was $100,000 and the lowest bid you could get from Ketchikan or Seward was $1 million, that we would be... Okay, I'm looking at the original, I guess. So my question is not valid. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
I've got Mr. Kubley.
I didn't get to the committee substitute for the second sponsor substitute.
Thank you, Chairman Adams and distinguished members of the Finance Committee. For the record, my name is Don Kubley, and today I'm wearing several hats. This testimony will be on behalf of my clients, the Ketchikan Gateway Borough, the City of Ketchikan, the City of Saxman, the Inland Boatmen's Union of the Pacific, and the Masters, Mates, and Pilots Union. And I want to thank you for the privilege of addressing you today. I'm here today to testify in support of HB 181, which is a bill relating to the Marine Maintenance Facility of State Ferries in Alaska. I will try to keep this brief as possible, as I know you have a busy schedule to keep up with. At a time in our history when we are busy weaning ourselves from the oil revenues, we have come to expect for the last several years, it's essential that we Alaskans now concentrate on diversification of our economy to new industries and revenue sources, and again to try and revitalize the traditional renewable resource industries that built this state prior to the founding of Prudhoe Bay, such as timber, fishing, tourism, and mining. In regards, to the new industries that will create jobs for Alaskans, and at the same time keep revenues in the state that in the past have flowed outside, such as the fuel savings cost on running the ferries to Seattle, the travel cost of running the ferry workers and sailors back and forth from Alaska to Seattle, and just simply hiring outside help and contracts to maintain our ferries. The marine maintenance facilities in Ketchikan and Seward provide us with an excellent opportunity to take one of the many steps that will be needed in diversifying the state's economy and reduce our dependence on oil. I think HB 181 would support this effort, and I would respectfully ask the distinguished members of the Finance Committee to support this legislation.
Any questions?
I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Kubley.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Does anybody want to testify on this particular bill? It's going into subcommittee consisting of Ripson Szymanski, Ripson Duncan, and Ripson Hewling. Nothing to come before? House of Finance.
Please come to order. The first bill we'll take up is committee substitute for sponsor substitute for House Bill number 466, Judiciary and Acrelag, relating to Alaska resident employment and preference. After hearing testimony this afternoon, I will be sending this into a subcommittee consisting of Representative Horschow, Representative Szymanski, and Representative Euling,
to look not only at the bill but at the fiscal note that has accompanied this particular bill. Here to testify as a sponsor, Representative Boucher.
Thank you very much, Chairman Adams. I'll be brief because we've heard a lot about this issue. We discussed it this morning, resident purchase of our timber and of our resources. And one of the things that I feel good about the word Alaska hire is not so much the territorialism of the section, but the concept that in a period of declining revenues, that Alaskans have always looked to each other as our major resource. And I feel that we're still a very wealthy state, certainly a extremely wealthy state in terms of the entrepreneurship of the individual. It's a lot of people, when I talked about resident hire or Alaska hire or local hire, it's just, I'd like to say Alaskan hire, period. Whether it's the new Alaskan or the old timer, the person in rural Alaska or the person in urban Alaska. So what we have done during the interim, thanks to the support of the chairman and others, is to take a look at the bigger picture, to read everything that's been said in all of the court cases, to remove some of the heat and the emotionalism and try and come with a small beachhead which will establish opportunity for Alaskans to participate in the fruits of their endeavor. Simply say, to me right now, without knocking Pacific Rim Enterprise or what have you, to have a $20 million project going in Seward and not be sure whether all the people in Seward who are capable of being able to work can work on that, and then once there to work the people in the other areas, concerns me greatly, without being, as I said, jingoistic on the thing. So recognize that the court, in its wisdom, has provided us some direction, and we have tried to follow that. It's not easy. It involves not only law, it involves financing. So, Chairman Adams, we recognize that there is a substantial fiscal note on it, but we feel that we can sit down and show what the purpose of it is for. And with that, I won't say any more on it. I'm just glad. I'm kind of proud that a year ago as a freshman I came here and I says, well, I think I'm going to concentrate on a resident hire bill this year. And somebody said, well, that went out with Button Shoes. That went out with you and Bill Egan. And I'm glad to see that now people are running on this issue. But it's more than just an Anchorage issue. It has to address the small village where people come in there and pound nails. I mean, a person from Anchorage coming into a village and taking their job away is every bit as much concern to them as the person coming from Seattle. So we have to take a look at the entire picture. And Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I feel that we have done that. That doesn't mean it's perfect, but we've tried to work as close as we could to making a constitutional bill that recognizes the need for Alaskans to participate in the fruits of their own endeavor. So I thank you for your time. And
is there any question of the sponsor regarding this piece of legislation? Yes,
Mr. Chairman, I'd just like to thank you. You on the legislation read, and also say that we'll try to set up a subcommittee meeting, probably Tuesday afternoon meeting with your and Representative Ewing and Representative Simmons' schedules. So we'll start work immediately.
Okay, I appreciate that very much.
Yes, thank you, Representative.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
At this time, the chair will call up the Department of Labor, Mr. Cadwell and Landau. If you can pull up the chair there. Would you state your name for the record, please?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Bob Landau, Deputy Commissioner from the Department of Labor. Together with me is Mr. Chuck Caldwell, who is the head of our research and analysis section at the Department of Labor. In view of the fact that the committee intends to delegate specific review of the fiscal notes to a subcommittee, which is our understanding, we thought what we would do today is just give you a brief overview of what this bill means to the Department of Labor, how it would affect us, how we would generally implement the bill. And at the conclusion of that, of course, we'd be happy to answer any questions you might have. Before I ask Mr. Caldwell to head into an overview of the bill, however, I'd like to put the bill in a little bit of perspective, and I'd like to add to some of the remarks that Representative Boucher just made. First of all, as I think most of you recognize, this is not a simple bill. It's a complex piece of legislation. It's the product of many different minds. It attempts to address and interweave various different aspects, including legal aspects, economic and statistical aspects, and administrative aspects. And one point I would make in opening is simply to say that when you look at the bill, to please understand that many of these things are interweaved, and when a part of the bill has been changed, it has affected other parts of the bill, that all of the components work together. The bill has gone through about 8 or 10 versions. In addition, there are a number of other bills related to House Bill 466 that deal with local hire in other contexts. There's a local hire bill for oil and gas and natural resource industries, and there's a tax credit for local hire bill. There are a number of efforts, and those have been interrelated as well. In particular, House Bill 466 has been coordinated with Senate Bill 271, which is the Natural Resource Industries Local Hire Bill, and we have attempted throughout our work on this bill to coordinate the two so that at the very minimum we have a single administrative mechanism for administering both bills rather than have two completely different systems. That would obviously have an effect on the fiscal side as well. Another point to make in connection with this interrelationship has to do with the fiscal note specifically, as the bill stands right now, as House Bill 466 stands right now, if it is funded in its present version, we believe that our fiscal note on the natural resource bill, Senate Bill 271, would likely be zero, barring, of course, further changes to the bills. We have gone through several fiscal notes on this bill. We've tried to keep up with the substantive changes that have been made to the bill, and there have been quite a few. In addition, we sent in a letter dated yesterday to you, Mr. Chairman, and I believe the members of the committee received it as well, recommending several minor clarifications to the bill, and we would ask that that be considered as well. Finally, I'd want to talk a little bit about the fiscal side of it. In view of the present budget situation, it's incumbent on all of us, including the Department of Labor, to do whatever we can to make the bill as efficient and as economical as possible. However, there's a background to local hire. It is clear now that we're going to have to go well beyond a simple legislative solution to local hire, and that it will cost some money to put together the body of statistics and economic information that the courts have very expressly asked for. There are still some questions about how far the courts will ask us to go in putting together economic support and statistical foundation for local hire preferences, but it's clear that we have to go well beyond our past efforts. As you examine the substance of the bill, there may well be some options to change the fiscal notes to reduce the fiscal impact, and we'll certainly be working with the subcommittee with that in mind. But again, before you embark on that process, we ask that you consider all the different aspects of the bill, particularly the issues of legal defensibility and the administration of the bill and the collection of that statistical information. It's a complicated area. Mr. Caldwell will describe it a little bit in a little greater detail. And that's where a lot of the money would be tied up. With that introduction, Mr. Chairman, I'll ask Mr. Caldwell to go into a brief overview of the bill.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Chuck Caldwell. As Bob mentioned, I'm Chief of Research. The bill is quite complex from the standpoint that it was tailored to meet a specific legal background.
and that legal background I'll just touch on, in order to get any waiver from the Privileges and Immunities Clause, there had to be proof that the employment of non-residents was a peculiar source of the unemployment of residents, and that we had to, in order to prove this, prove that the Alaskans had the same skills, the Alaskans who were unemployed had the same skills as the non-residents who were employed in those jobs. Additionally, the requirements were that there should be substantial evidence that unemployment was causing serious social and economic ills, and that any proposed resident hire solution would fit the documented problem. Because of this, we'll probably see, over the next few years, several bills covering very specific facets of the local hire problem, as opposed to one bill that just brings all Alaskans into coverage. There's a much greater chance of having that legal. The bill is quite specific in triggering area designations which would be eligible, and also designating which categories of individuals within those areas would be eligible for the preference. Our fiscal note was tailored to the requirements of the legislation. We have been working on information system design to provide this information by census area. Again, that ties in with the requirements of the legislation. This goes well beyond what was done in the resident hire study we did last year, where we only had to identify the residency by the state of Alaska or outside of Alaska. This increases the data processing costs tremendously, as does getting proof of actual displacement over a broader spectrum of occupations for smaller geography. I won't go into extreme detail unless I'm asked. I have written this all out in fiscal note analysis, and can respond to any questions of that at the pleasure of the chairman. A key element in here in the cost, though, is collection from employers of the occupational titles of the workers. And with this information, we will convert this to numeric code so that we can process it better and more accurately in the computer, and we will obtain resident status through extensive computer matching by the various 23 census areas in the state of Alaska. This goes well beyond what's been done in any state. We know we can handle the processing. We had a good trial run last year when we did the computer matching to produce a resident hire study. This bill happens to be targeted at state-funded construction. And as Representative Boucher mentioned, we need to get a beachhead. Its impact will be far broader. And as Mr. Landau indicated, the information required to do this parallels the information required for the bill, Senate Bill 271, and its House Complement 367 on natural resource development. The information has far more benefits than just those two pieces of legislation, and a requirement of this legislation is that we address in our annual report methods to increase resident hire. We will be able to pinpoint by area, occupation, industry, resident status, where the problems on resident hire are, and be able to further explore potential solutions cooperatively with elected and appointed officials in the Department of Law. The state also has a benefit that by taking action where it has an economic interest, that it sets an example to convince private employers to do likewise in employing Alaskans. I'll be free to answer any questions.
Mr. Representative Larson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For my own knowledge here, I guess I need to kind of get a definition. Could you give me a definition as to who would qualify under Alaskan hire or who would qualify under resident hire? I once heard a definition, someone that arrived at 10 o'clock this morning on the airplane and said that they intend to remain in Alaska, that they would qualify for Alaskan hire. And I guess I'm looking for you to tell me that isn't so, but that there is a defined definition of what we mean by Alaskan hire or resident hire.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Larson, there's a specific definition of resident in the bill, and it cross-references back to the definition of residency in Title I, which is it's kind of an all-purpose residency definition that's been used for many programs. Basically, what that would require would be physical presence in the state plus a principal place of residence established in the state. And the department, through regulation, could establish the criteria to use to indicate how long you have to be at your principal place of residence. The statute says 30 days, but it allows the department to set out other indicia of residency by regulation, and we would no doubt amplify that. We would go beyond just the physical presence and the 30 days.
Mr. Chairman, if I may elaborate just a little then, that a person who has physically resided in Alaska and who has established a place of residence then for 30 days would qualify then under resident hire. Maybe we use the two terms then synonymously are the same, but is there a difference between resident hire and Alaskan hire?
That's a difficult question to answer in the context of this bill. The bill is presently written sets up what are essentially local hire preferences. First of all, to clarify my answer to your previous question, in order to be eligible for preference, one has to be more than a resident. One has to be qualified for work on the public construction project, in other words, be trained or experienced in one or more of the construction trades. In addition, one would have to fit into the four categories of unemployment or underemployment that are spelled out in the bill. So there's basically a residency determination, an unemployment determination, and a qualifications determination. Part of the qualifications determination involves the concept of availability. The preference would not apply to somebody who's already gainfully employed in an occupation that uses their training and their skills. Those would be the various steps for somebody to qualify for the preference. There's more than one preference created under this bill. There are actually, I believe, it started out as three separate preferences, one for residents of underemployed areas, a second one for residents of economically distressed areas, and then a third one for minority residents of areas with a high minority population and high minority unemployment. The bill was changed in the last committee to add a fourth category of preference, and that would be for female applicants. It's conceivable that in looking at a particular region or area of the state that you could trigger the female hiring preference, the minority hiring preference, or both at the same time. So what we've got really are four preference categories right now.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I agree with Representative Boucher. We're on the beachhead. We have a ways to go.
Yes, Representative Ewing.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Maybe historically you could give me a little bit of background. I know last year we worked on a bill that Representative Boucher sponsored, and I didn't have the opportunity of following that through the Senate and if that became law. And if it did become law, what has been the allocation of that $100,000 for the two extra positions and the hefty fiscal note, and where are we with it if it has passed? I plead innocence on it. I don't know what happened on that, if it passed or not.
Mr. Chairman, if I might, there's been quite a bit of history since all of that happened. I'll try and fill you in on what I know. The main purpose of the bill that was passed last year was to add in findings to the existing local hire law, the one that was recently struck down by our Supreme Court. We asked the court last summer, after those findings became law, to consider them as part of the court case. They declined to do that. And the point is that to this day, they have still not considered those findings as a part of their local hire ruling. The court decision that came out in January was based on information and statistics that were at least 2 years old, going back to the time of trial. So all of the work that was done last year, the bill that was passed last year, is still valid and it has the potential to be useful in a future court challenge. It does not mean that what we're doing this year would replace what was done last year. It would be in addition to. As far as the $100,000, as I recall, the amount that was given to the Department of Labor to conduct a special study of non-resident employment, resident unemployment, and to look particularly at the public construction sector, was reduced to $80,000. I believe we used all of that amount, and I think we may have even taken some additional money elsewhere out of our budget to finish up the work, but that's what paid for the study that came out in January. One important difference between the work that we would do from here on out in terms of gathering information and what's in that report is that report focused primarily on public construction. What we're talking about doing now under this bill is really much broader. We would be looking at all industries and all occupations in all areas of the state, and we would try to determine where non-residents are showing up in the greatest numbers. That's going to have a great deal of value, not just for local hire purposes, but for things like allocating training money, to know in what occupations or industries additional training might be needed to put more Alaskans to work. So it's really going to be a much broader approach. We're not just going to focus on public construction.
Any questions? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Could you guys take us through an example of a public work project and how, after an area had been, you know, designated for, as a preference, how those actual hiring practices would occur?
Are you asking for the link between the statistics and the enforcement, or?
Yeah, enforcement, I guess, is what I'm looking at.
Under the old law, there are a couple of differences. One that comes to mind right away is the minority hire aspect. We've never, at least not in the Department of Labor, had to do a minority determination. Under this bill, we would have to decide whether somebody fits into a minority category. Our fiscal notes almost entirely address the question of gathering information and statistics to support the bill in court. There's virtually nothing in there for enforcement purposes because we still have the same staff that has been working on voluntary compliance on local hire since the law was ruled unenforceable. That would be the same staff that would do the enforcement under this bill. In most respects, it would be the same. They would be auditing certified payrolls and public construction projects that are required to be filed every week. They would make residency determinations by reviewing all of the applications that people would file to obtain preference. We're thinking of running the program very much like the permanent fund dividend program, where the Department of Revenue audits PFD applications, and they have to make a residency determination as part of that. And the way we would do it would be by cross-matching with permanent fund dividend information. If somebody has received or was eligible for a permanent fund dividend, they're a resident. That answers that question. With some other people who may not be eligible, it's a little more difficult because not every Alaskan applies for a PFD, and not there are new Alaskans who are bona fide residents who would not yet qualify for the PFD. So there's some wrinkles to it, but basically we would do it pretty much the way we did it under the old law.
We continue. Now, would a person come to the department before they applied for a job to get a either a preference, to be declared in a preference category, or to be declared a resident?
Under the original version of this bill, yes, but we recommended that rather than have the department spend the resources to have to actually register every person that wanted a job, that the best system would be a system of self-certification where an applicant would fill out a form that we've prepared under penalty of perjury, and they would answer a number of questions concerning residency, unemployment status, and qualifications to work on a public works project. We would monitor and audit those applications. Certainly, if an applicant filled out a form and went to an employer, a prospective employer, and asked for a job on a public works project, and the employer had some question about whether this was really a legitimate resident or not, then they could come to the Department of Labor and it would trigger our audit function. We felt that considerable money could be saved by doing it that way, self-certification, rather than having us either affirmatively register everybody ourselves or keep lists of anybody that might be qualified with all the mm-hmm. changes that might be involved in something mm-hmm. like that.
Mm-hmm. If I could continue, Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
So a person will be eligible after 30 days residence in the state, is that?
As a basic matter, yes, but we are likely to require other indicia to show intention to remain permanently. I very much doubt we're going to stop just at the 30 days and leave it at that, because I think we all recognize that there are non-residents that come up for the summertime intending to go back. So the question of intent is a difficult one to pin down, and it is true that in some cases that determination is going to be difficult. Our past experience under the old law was that was not as much of a problem as we might have expected. Yeah, I think it was less than 5% of all the cases.
Under the old law, was it effective before it was struck down? I know we had a lot of non-residents working up here before the old law was struck down. Did you kick anybody out? Obviously, the one guy lost his job, but I mean, was he one person, or was there hundreds or thousands, or how many people actually lost? Or do you have any sense of whether it was effective? I guess
we've got information.
Excuse me, I can't hear.
My answer? Yes. When we did our survey, we found that by cross-matching the permanent fund and dividend information to information that was already in the Department of Labor, when we compared the percentages of non-residents in public funded construction to the percentage of non-residents in construction as a whole, there was significantly lower percentage of non-residents in the public funded construction. In addition, I'm sure that because of having it known that this law was in place, we probably also induced fewer non-residents to come up to the state who might have later been employed in other types of construction.
Thank you.
Representative Samansky, then Larson.
And we'll probably get into a little more of this in the subcommittee, but when you look at page 3 and you look at the eligibility for preference, basically, the first criteria is resident, which could be, I don't know, the most liberal term between the 30 days. And then you pick up and 1, 2, and 3, or number 4, which is the further qualifier of resident in order to give you the preference. And that's really the preference. That's where you lock it in. Just one question. I just was out of curiosity, and it just dawned on me. Agreeing with Bill. That fourth item talks about job training program approved by the department. Under the bill, would it be the Department of Education or the Department of Labor?
Mr. Chairman, that would be the Department of Labor.
They currently don't certify educational institutions, do they?
No, we don't. I don't believe we approve or certify job training programs. We would have to develop a program to do that. We would have to set out criteria to approve job training programs.
I guess when we'll talk about it again, maybe there's a way we can work that in and just pick up a post-secondary commission or something like that already is doing that function.
Red Rips and Larson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Like, we've got the best again of me. The other day, for an example, I had a phone call that one of our local employment agencies had an employee with an out-of-state license plate working there. And upon following that up, we got the answer that, true, the employee did have an out-of-plate license plate. However, under the state register, the employee qualified as a resident. What is the qualification for a resident under the state register?
Representative Larson, you're asking about somebody applying for a state job, or
someone who was employed by the state because they qualified as a resident under the state's register. They were on the state register as a resident, and they qualified as a resident. And I guess my question is, what are the qualifications to qualify as a state resident under the present state register?
That's a question I think would have to be put to the Department of Administration. I don't know what criteria they might have for putting somebody on the register as a resident.
The point I was trying to make, Mr. Chairman, is sometimes we have to look very closely at our own employment here.
Representative Frank?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Getting back to the job training program, what if somebody hasn't completed a job training program, but he's worked in the field all his life? I mean, I worked as a equipment operator for several years, and I never did take a training program. But I was a member of a union, and I assumed that I would be qualified, you know. I guess I'd hate to see you make a decision about whether I was qualified or not, and I'm just wondering how you're going to handle that.
Mr. Chairman, if I could clarify that for you. The four categories of unemployment that Representative Szymanski alluded to earlier, those are all in the disjunctive. You can qualify by fitting into one of those four. So that by completing an approved job training program, that would only be one way of qualifying. There's another category there for people who are simply not working but have merely registered to find work with a public or private employment agency or local hiring hall. That's certainly an alternative way to do it. The other thing is, the point I'd want to make is, we will not be qualifying people. The Department of Labor will not be doing that. We will be approving job training programs under that one category. The prospective employer would have the ultimate right to decide who gets hired or not. All this bill sets up is who is entitled to a preference. The employer still decides who gets hired, subject to the percentages that they would have to meet.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So that it's the percentages that if they fell out below a percentage of compliance, then they would be out of compliance with the law and then subject to penalties.
That's correct, and that's similar to how the old law worked.
Okay.
Yes, Representative Julie.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. One last question. I was just glancing through the sectional analysis, and if we go to 3610-200, I'm not sure what pages it's on, and also 3610-210, and I'm just going through the third page of Representative Boucher's sectional analysis, and I was interested specifically when we get into the criminal penalties. I read this through the sectional saying, a person, whether an employer or an applicant for employment, is subject to criminal prosecution for perjury if the certification of eligibility is falsified. And then it goes on and it says, in the case of an individual, all future rights to eligibility for employment preference may be taken away. Now, does that mean that the individual would only have his employment preference taken away, or would he be charged with some kind of a felony or a misdemeanor and under some kind of a criminal penalty? And that also goes for the employer, too, I assume, under perjury. But I wonder if that actually sets up a misdemeanor or if that's...
I'm going to at this time ask Ron Lawrenson, who is with Department of Law, is next on it. Okay, we'll just hold that question.
Thank you.
Any further questions of Department of Law? Gentlemen, thank you both. I wish you'd work with Representative Porcio. We will be looking at your amendments on your letter dated April 3rd and also the physical notes dated April 2nd and 3rd. Thank you.
Thank you.
Ron? Ron, did you hear the, would you state your name for the record, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Ron Lawrenson, Deputy Attorney General in the Department of Law. I did hear the question that the penalty basically of forfeiting future entitlement to benefit preferences is an additional penalty in addition to the criminal penalties for a perjury misdemeanor.
Mr. Chairman, if I might continue then, also, are the criminal penalties for the employer and the individual exactly the same?
Yes.
There's not, in other words, the employer wouldn't have a heftier kind
of... Right, no, in terms of what the criminal statutes provide for perjury, they're the same.
Okay, don't let me interrupt.
I'm here basically to answer questions, respond to questions that you might have. I've worked pretty closely with the Department of Labor and Representative Boucher and the earlier committees that have looked over this legislation. And in the scheme of the sort of, you know, it's always difficult to call what the likelihood of success is in the area of resident hire, I feel pretty good about this particular approach to dealing with a problem, and I've indicated to the Judiciary Committee that I thought our chances in litigation were at least 50-50 in terms of getting it upheld. Just to sort of preface any questions you might have with that observation.
Representative Szymanski, then Frank.
Briefly,
This legislation, if it was on the books today, as written, would apply to all projects, basically, that the state funds. Would it apply to state employment practices?
This legislation as written here does not deal with state employment practices of its own personnel, no.
By including them?
It would have to go in a different portion of the Alaska statutes. Title 39 is the one that deals with state personnel.
But I mean,
it would certainly be possible to put similar kinds of provisions in there. The Department of Administration already operates under some resident hire requirements for hiring of various state employee positions.
But if we did include them, would this be stronger and better local hire provisions for the state of Alaska itself?
No, I don't think so. The legal arguments that deal with the state employing its own personnel are different than the kinds of problems we face with public construction, where it's just state money that's providing for activities that are then carried out in the private sector. It's really a different legal approach to the problem. I think you could deal with it in a different... You don't need to approach it this way to deal with resident hire of state employees.
You suggested some that would say, you know, we don't do it as good as we should with regard to the state of Alaska itself, but giving resident preference. I'd be interested, maybe in the subcommittee we can get into that and give me a legal opinion or some kind of a memo that says this is how the state's doing it. It's a much better position than if you tried to do it here.
Representative Frank.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Lawrence, could you get into the findings that the Supreme Court responded to? I guess it was, they say here that you have to have a particular source of evil, that non-residents have to have or be a particular source of evil. Could you elaborate on how this bill is addressing that?
Really what the state Supreme Court indicated in its opinion is what's going to have to be satisfied is, first off, this notion that non-residents present a particular source or peculiar source is really the legal jargon of the peculiar source of the problem that the state wishes to attempt to cure. And the problem is unemployment in part, but really what the state Supreme Court has said is that the problem has to be more than mere unemployment. What the state has to identify is additional social or economic consequences as a result of unemployment of residents. And that's really what this bill, the findings aspect, and the gathering of the data that the Department of Labor is talking about are really aimed at, is being able to correlate unemployment among Alaska residents with other social and economic problems, not just the fact that they are out of jobs, but that it leads, that the fact that there's high unemployment leads to problems of alcoholism, problems of family and child abuse, perhaps. I'm just giving examples of that, and other kinds of social and economic ills that the legislature says are serious that we have to deal with, and one way of dealing with them is attempting to reduce unemployment among our own residents. And that's the whole philosophy of this approach of this legislation, is to identify those kinds of problems and then target preferences to in a hope to help alleviate them.
Is there any kind of precedent anywhere to believe that, or to lead us to believe that the Supreme Court would allow us to attack it in this manner?
Well, just...
Or was it based upon their decision?
Based on reading their decision and sort of reading from what they said and also things they didn't say as being areas where it seems to still be open. One thing they did say is that they read U.S. Supreme Court decisions in the area as contemplating it being okay for states to attempt to address grave social and economic consequences. Now, what grave means, we got into some debate on that in the House Judiciary Committee in terms of how bad the problems have to be. Ultimately, that's the sort of thing we're only going to find out by litigating, is how bad a problem it has to be before the state can respond to it. Thank you.
Representative Ringstead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ron, in the discussion of who this applies to and the comments applying to state-funded projects, I've heard that there's a going argument regarding municipalities. We give them grants for whatever reason, and the feeling is, with some legal backing, that once they have the money, then they're on their own, and they don't have to report to us or count to us or et cetera.
I guess my question would come as to how much weight is there in that argument and how does that apply to this? A lot of the state monies wind up going to municipalities to build their buildings, and if that doesn't work, then we're going to have to, I mean, somewhere we've got to try and tie that in.
Well, the discussion you're talking about, I think, is more a philosophical or policy-type problem than a legal problem. municipalities of the state are all political subdivisions of the state that derive their authority from state legislation and from state law. And to the extent the legislature deems it appropriate to place certain strings or restrictions or conditions on a municipality's receipt and expenditure of state funds, it's appropriate for the legislature to do that. Municipalities may or may not agree with the legislature's decision to do that in a particular case, but I don't have any problem saying that it's legal for you to do that.
My understanding was there's something somewhere in the statutes that says that once they get the money, they're on their own. Are you familiar with any area?
I don't know specifically what you're referring to, but again, if it's in a statute,
I don't either.
You're the legislature, and you can change the statutes.
I don't know where it is, but it's been pointed out to me that there is something. I guess the way it came to me is in going back and trying to audit and account for funds. Grant funds have been given to municipalities, and we go back and try to find out where did the money really go. And I can see where we may have the same problem here when you go back and say, okay, who did you really hire? If they're going to tell us what, did they say, no, we don't have to tell you where the money went, they may do the same thing.
No, I don't think that's a problem here. This legislation specifically addresses municipal grants and incorporates the funds that are expended on our municipal grants in these preferences.
Thank you. Representative Fischow?
That was my call.
Representative Larson?
Oh, thank you. Yes, you alluded twice to possible answers to one of my earlier questions. And one of the statements you made is that our state employees are really not covered under this piece of legislation.
That's right.
But that in order to qualify to be on the register for possible state employment, you have to have some residency requirements. Could you tell me what those residency requirements might be presently?
I'm honestly not real familiar with how the Department of Administration operates its registers and the placement of residents versus non-residents. I believe it's personnel rules through regulations that provide for basically two lists. First, a list of all qualified residents as they're ranked, and then non-residents below that. I think it's the same 30-day presence with an intent to remain with a principal place of residence in the state type requirement that Bob Landau was talking about.
I guess I'll have to ask the Department of Administration.
Thank you. Representative Frank.
Is there some legal distinction between a public works project and development of state-owned resources? I mean, how come we don't have that provision in this bill?
Well, I guess there are several answers to this. First, a policy call as to whether or not oil and gas type activities would be covered at all. Secondly, to the extent that they would be covered, they'd have to be covered by legislation that dealt with different titles, different provisions of the Alaska statute. Like these are all changes to Title 36, and natural resources are in Title 38. There is a bill in the Senate right now that deals with preferences very similar to this on oil and gas or natural resource project type activities.
Is there any reason to believe that our chances of a favorable decision from the Supreme Court, from any court, is better limiting it to public works projects?
If I were going to rank the chances of success, I'd say we have a somewhat higher chance of success on public projects preferences than we do on oil and gas preferences. I guess in a sort of a hierarchy, I think where you're talking about direct expenditure of state funds, you've got a somewhat stronger argument than where you're talking about just the use of state lands.
Thank you.
Representative Boucher, did you have a comment?
Mr. Chairman, if I may just comment, it's kind of like getting married. You hold the girl's hand first.
That's old fashioned.
Kind of a two level approach.
Sorry. Any further questions? Thank you, sir, for your testimony.
I have one quick question.
Representative,
if you did include state oil and gas leases in a bill like this, would it be would a court be able to find it severable, rule one way on one, another way on another, so it wouldn't really endanger the hand-holding if you went ahead and got married in the same bill?
I think that's right. The court would look at each of these programs separately and, I guess, possibly uphold one and not uphold the other.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lawrence, for your time. Is there anybody else that would like to testify on this particular bill?
Representative Porcheau, I'd like to have this bill as early as possible next week. When is your first subcommittee meeting, please?
We're looking at Tuesday, possibly 4 p.m.
4 p.m. on Tuesday for any people interested in this particular. Thank you, sir. The next bill we'll go into is House Bill number 440. We have before us a committee substitute for House Bill number 440, Finance, an act relating to recreation management plan, implement the Bristol Bay Area Plan and provide for an effective date. This particular bill would require development of a recreation management plan for Bristol Bay Area. DNR has submitted a fiscal note for $100,000. With the help of the sponsor, I've prepared a fiscal note for you to consider that lowers it to $75,000. Also, we have a drafted CS, which the CS is on page number 3, lines 11 through 16 is the new language there. Here to testify on this bill is Representative Herman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Adelheid Herman. I represent the Bristol Bay Area as well as Solutions and Pribilof Islands. Regarding House Bill 440, as many of you know, Alaska has more recreational users coming to the state. Many of these people, as well as Alaska residents, are visiting the Bristol Bay region because of the fisheries resources make the region especially attractive because of the presence of some of the world's largest and most prized salmon and rainbow trout runs, and because of the uniqueness and beauty of the area. I want to describe some of the conflicts growing out of the increased recreational fisheries use of the area. Number one, there are conflicts with subsistence activities. Number two, there is trespass on private lands. Number three, local people are concerned about the garbage left behind. Number four, many people raise the question, can increased pressure on the resource allow the resource to be sustained? There seems to be no data on these questions. There seems to be growing conflict between local guides and new guides unfamiliar with the region. As a decision maker for the region and as a representative for the region, I alone cannot begin to make policy on the varied concerns involving different user groups. What I've always found helpful in these situations is to have all the different parties involved sit down and figure out what needs to be done. This is why I've introduced House Bill 440. I believe this is a strong step in this direction, which will allow the local people, the state, and the recreation users to come up with a recreation management plan that is a benefit to everyone. Mr. Chairman, finance members, as you may know, there was a cooperative planning effort done for the Bristol Bay Area, where federal, state, and local people were all involved in an extensive planning process. Unfortunately, there was not a cooperative plan adopted, but instead the state adopted a plan and the feds adopted a plan, but each entity in their respective plans recommended further study on the concerns surrounding the recreational issue. Mr. Chairman, I want to emphasize again the need for all parties to sit down and figure out a plan for how the recreational potential for the area can be developed compatibly with the current activities on the rivers and still take into account the influx of new activities without jeopardizing the resources. The plan is needed, and I appreciate your support.
So any questions of the sponsor? Yes, Representative Winstead.
Representative Herman, I'm curious, why is it you think that you need recreation out there? You don't get enough of it down here?
I think the whole state is looking at Bristol Bay for recreation.
Oh, I can come recreate too?
Sure.
Oh, okay.
We're not locking you out.
Representative Larson.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Herman, one of the things that popped up when I read the bill was on the advisory committee, which would be on page 2, starting with line 9. And I guess one of the reasons why it popped up again was your statement that basically said that all parties involved should sit down and determine what needs to be done. I think that's a very good philosophy. However, I'm wondering here is if we're following through on that with the advisory committee. For an example, number 3 there on line 12 says a representative of the Bristol Bay Coastal Resource Service Area Board. That means the advisory committee will consist of a person who is nominated from them by them. Number 4, a representative of the Bristol Bay Borough Coastal District. Once again, it will be someone nominated from them by them. Number 6, a representative of the Bristol Bay Native Association. Once again, someone from them by them. But then we get to 7, 8, and 9. We would have excuse me, 8 and 9, we'd have a representative of the Bristol Bay commercial fishing community, a representative of the Bristol Bay sports fishing community, and I guess the one that popped into my mind, a representative of the South Central Alaska sports fishing community. But those last three groups would not select their own representative, but their representative would be nominated from groups 3, 4, 5, and 6. And I'm just wondering there if we should not let each of the groups from 3 to 9 each nominate their own representative instead of having three of those groups nominate their own and three of those groups having someone else nominate the representative for them.
Mm-hmm. Representative Larson, first of all, 7, 8, and 9 would only be picked by 3 and 4. I mean, the people, the Bristol Bay Coastal Resource Service Area Board and the Bristol Bay Coastal Resource Service Area Board. From my understanding of, you know, people that are involved outside the region on the planning, on planning teams is very limited, if any, that have ever let other people from outside the region onto their planning team. But it was brought to my attention that, you know, possibly someone from the Alaska South Central sports fishing community, you know, it would be good to have them on here. And I think that it would be, because I think a lot of the glitches in the whole plan will be ironed out, you know, because of that person being on there. So as a courtesy to a member on the Resources Committee, minority member, I put this in there. But I would still also like some checks and balances by the Bristol Bay people to say who that is, just as they have some, you know, saying who the Bristol Bay sports fish person is and who the Bristol Bay commercial fisherman is. I have a letter of intent that say, like, if the Bristol Bay sports fish person was picked out of the Nooshigak area, then maybe people in Nakni, King Salmon, or Iliamna would have concern that, hey, we don't have any representation on there. But nothing says that, you know, subgroups can be formed.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Herman, I guess my concern is still this. If we're talking, say, about representation from the South Central sports fishing community, and the South Central sports fishing community doesn't have any say on who the representative is going to be, because it has been selected from among their membership by someone else, is that the type of representation that we're looking for? Are we looking for someone from South Central sports fishing community appointed by the South Central sports fishing community for this job? And
well,
and I guess that's the concern.
Yeah, I would just like to, you know, keep the people in Bristol Bay involved in who this person is. I don't think there's anything that won't allow the people from the sports fishing group to say, this, you know, we'd like this person, it to be this person. And then the commissioner has the final say on, you know, who's picked, because these are nominations to her.
Mr. Vice Chairman, I guess that's still my concern. And the way I see it right now, it's from groups 3 and 4 are going to nominate who they want, say, from group 7, 8, or 9, who they're going to nominate, who they want from group 7, 8, or 9 to the commissioner, so that the commissioner then can select one of those three. And it's a concern that I have here.
I'd like to keep it the way it is in the bill, because it was, you know, it was a courtesy on my part to even put in South Central Alaska, you know, on the board at
all. And I respect that.
Representative Ealing? Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My concerns are the same as Representative Larson's. I think he made some good points. I like the content of the bill, and I think it's good that you want to get all that input from the different the groups here, the 1, 2, 3, 4, all the way up to 9. But it seems like it's a little bit overcomplicated to me. And I guess I really like Representative Larson's point. I'm not just trying to make a point for the sake of making a point, but it seems like it would be a lot more straightforward if you didn't have to go through the third party of the Commissioner of National Resources nominating someone from another group. In other words, if the group wants to nominate someone, they should be able to nominate it. And it probably can be structured. I think it has to be looked at carefully, but I think it can be structured so it, you know, that the right group gets the right representation. But I think it needs some work.
Other questions in terms of asking?
Well, real frank with the representative sponsors, I share their concern on it. I don't know if we want to look at today or whenever, but I'm also concerned with the fiscal note attached to it, not knowing, and maybe we can have the department come up.
Ned's here to answer some questions. We've got one more witness.
Okay, so we'll just wait until he gets up, but I'll talk to them about the fiscal note. Much grain in each bag to feed each one of these departments, and they start gnawing on this portion of the grain. I don't know what they're going to feed on after.
Mr. Chairman, can I just make a last comment? I think it's a good bill, and it just needs a little bit of refinement. Now we can do it. We can pass out of here and do it in rules, or it doesn't. There's some little things in it that just need to be corrected. I don't know if you want to spend the time doing it now. Or.
Let's get to our witnesses first. Other questions, Representative Herman? Thank you, ma'am. Ned, did you want to come up?
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. My name is Ned Farquhar from the Department of Natural Resources. And just briefly, I'd like to say the department approves of the concept in the bill. The recreation plan that is proposed in this bill is something that was envisioned by the people who put together the Bristol Bay Area Plan. They recognized that recreation uses were going to be growing and becoming more controversial over the future. And actually, in the Bristol Bay Area Plan, they suggested this kind of an effort. So this is the kind of thing that the department had proposed or conceived of doing sometime in the future. And what this bill does is it brings the plan into the schedule now, and it provides the funding to be able to do it now. Although we do have one small problem with it in the CS, in the language that's being added, we had recommended that on page 3 at line 11 that there should not be a deferral of development of recreation facilities or a prohibition on issuing leases for commercial recreation purposes during this planning process, just because as a precedent, we don't want to see planning holding up land management activities anywhere in the state. And we feel that if there is adopted by the legislature an approach here that requires us not to conduct some kind of land management activity during the planning process, that policy would be transferable to other areas of the state. And we want to be able to continue managing while we plan. That's the only problem that we have with the bill right now, and I'd be glad to answer your questions.
Questions, Mr. Farquhar?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. How would you suggest changing?
Mr. Chairman, we would recommend inserting, instead of that sentence, something like, prior to adoption of the plan, the commissioner shall consult with the advisory group on land and recreation management actions in the planning region. So in other words, we would, and that would be the end of it, we would try to make sure that during the actual planning process, we were working, our land managers were working with this planning group to be certain that the actions we're taking are reasonable. We don't want to be doing things that are going to conflict with the plan as it emerges in a couple of years, but we also don't wish to be prohibited from taking land management actions.
Questions, Mr. Proctor, Representative Maskey?
Going back to my single bag of grain process of feeding various departments, where does this sit with regard to overall priorities? I know that you're probably somewhat involved with the administration looking at your budget, but you got a choice between taking something outside of your existing budget and replacing it with this money. Are you prepared to do that? I mean, is it high priority?
Mr. Chairman, we have not provided a decrement with this bill and with this fiscal note, and we see it as something that would be in addition to the current planning schedule. It's not a priority item on the planning schedule right now. We have five area plans that are underway.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Cotton.
Yeah, I think that, you know, this is one of those examples of you know, it's a $55 million budget, and the Department of Natural Resources, and I think that the chairman of the Resources Committee probably gets to direct the activities of an employee. I don't think it's going to really affect the actual level of the Department of Natural Resources budget, so I think we can probably find space for it.
I've got another one for you then.
I don't know. Samantha.
I'd like to hear about it.
We're working on it.
Is this all that on?
No, this is, like I say, I think it'll work out, but I sure wouldn't call it an add-on. But I think that the Department of Natural Resources will surely find time for one of their employees to carry out this function. We're also working, Mr. Chairman, there's a subcommittee working on House Bill 93 that has to do with recreational rivers, and there's a part of the thing that we're not really hung up on, but we're discussing a plan and how much the department has to follow the workings of the plan. And that's what I get confused when we start talking about these plans. Once this plan's in place, does it have the effect of a statute? I mean, is the department going to follow the plan as though it were a law?
Mr. Chairman, obviously it doesn't have the effect of statute, but it gives the guidance that the land manager uses day to day. When an application comes in, he refers to the plan, looks at the maps and the policies, and sees whether or not what's proposed is consistent. If it looks like it isn't, he looks and sees if there are conditions on the land management in the guidelines that would allow it to be consistent.
Well, I wanted to ask Ed a question on this, too, then. So it sounds like you envision that it might take a couple of years to get this plan all put together. And that was what this, I guess this is a new finance language. It says until that all takes place, you don't want to let any commercial recreational or permanent recreation facilities. What exactly are we talking about there when we're talking about permanent recreation facilities?
Land use permits are for 1 year, and there are short-term leases that go up to 5 years, and then long-term leases go up to 55 years.
So a person would get a one-year short-term lease. What would they do with something like that?
Right now, Mr. Chairman, in that region, there are some people who have sport camps, fishing camps, and they set up a tent camp and bring people in for.
Is this like a woodpecker?
It's a little different from that one because it's not a permanent facility. It's just a tent camp, and they'll bring in people every year, and they'll apply and get a new permit every year. And that kind of person sometimes wants to get a longer-term lease so they can actually build a structure or leave things there over the winter.
So, okay, but now this would prohibit